Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission. Welcome back to the WFO Life Podcast. Good evening, Chris. How are you today?
Doing great. Just chilling in the thankfully cool man cave here. So.
Excellent. Same thing here. It's a hot day in South Texas, and glad to be done for the day. So today, we are jumping back into part two of 30 Causes of Failure. This, of course, was based on the book Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill. I thought the first session of this was awesome. There were so many life lessons in there. And I thought, why don't we just jump straight in? Because if you're interested in that, I recommend going back to the last episode and just, you know, maybe listen to that one first. But I think the way these are laid out, you could probably listen to them in either order. But you definitely want to catch all of them. Let's jump straight in, Chris. The first one is we finished last week with wrong selection of mate in marriage. That was number 15. So let's jump straight into number 16. So I'm going to read this and then we comment.
Sounds good.
Number 16, overcaution. The person who takes no chances generally has to take whatever is left when others are through choosing. Overcaution is as bad as undercaution. Both are extremes to be guarded against. Life itself is filled with the element of chance.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of something that came up last week, honestly, in the type of, paralysis by analysis, right? You don't want to, like, continue to be overly cautious as to not make a decision, right?
Right. Yeah, same here. I thought this was very reminiscent of a prior cause of failure. And there's many situations where a failure to act is definitely detrimental to any project. I've seen people, personal friends, that had a really cool idea, like an invention, and they talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. And it was like, well, I don't know, it'd be really taking a chance and I'd have to spend a lot of time on it and this and that. And then, a year goes by and you're like, hey, dude, I saw that for sale in Walmart. It's like it's already done. Well, over caution, you lost that element, that creativity. You lost the window of opportunity because you were too over cautious. So
yeah, I was gonna say, and last thing on this, in the military, I know if we have honestly decisions that people are maybe overly passionate about it, but so much so that they can't see other people's point of view. Sometimes that creates, an overcautiousness by others, just because somebody else really sees it, but you don't, you can be like, well, I really don't see that. So, making what we would say is a data-driven decision, right? If you, focus on the logic, if you look at the data and it's sound, then make a decision. But a lot of times the overcaution is because, like, you don't have enough information or you don't trust the person that's pitching it. There's something wrong if you're, forced to be overcautious, take the guessing out of it and move on.
Yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah.
Back to the book. Number 17, wrong selection of associates in business. This is one of the most common causes of failure in business. In marketing personal services, one should use great care to select an employer who will be an inspiration and who is himself intelligent and successful. We emulate those whom we associate most closely. Pick an employer who is worth emulating.
Yeah, it's almost like the mate for business, right?
Yeah, it's similar to number 15,
yeah.
For sure.
I mean, I was going to say, I know for me, I have a lot of friends that I love spending time with, but I may not want to become a business associate with. And I think that's where, people get into pitfalls, right? Family and friends, but maybe are not good business partners.
Yeah, as far as, you did point out that it is similar to picking a mate, but there's a lot of complexity to business, and it's not just about your personal compatibility, maybe like in a marriage, things like that, but there's also risk aversion. There's partners that have capital or don't have capital. There's people that, what's their attitude like? I know that's something that, when we talk with Rex Howes, the people you surround yourself, the attitudes they have can be a big factor in the success that a business has. And they also kind of, he kind of threw in here, okay, fine, some of us have an employer. And he made the point that when you have an employer, it's not just, oh, I just go to work and do my job. It's like, no, you should really choose who you work for. You should be inspired to some extent. I think that's kind of a different take on, you know, having a job and just, well, I just go to work and I'll just deal with my boss. It's like, no, we shouldn't have to just deal with a boss. We should work with and for people who maybe raise the bar a bit.
Yeah, that's when people are stressed out and miserable. You know, and a lot of times it's not even that their boss is a asshole or anything. It's just a bad matchup, right? It's like oil and water. And so if you can't get past those irreconcilable differences, you're never going to feel, you know, comfortable in your job. So it's you know, you can't you know, go to the shiny object, but not look to see what's behind it. So yeah, it's definitely you know, painful if you're in this situation.
Absolutely. Another cause of failure, number 18, superstition and prejudice. Superstition is a form of fear. It is also a sign of ignorance. Men who succeed keep open minds and are afraid of nothing. I think that's important. In recent weeks, with the whole COVID-19 thing, I've caught myself reflecting on the concept of fear a lot. Not personal fear, but just observing the fear that I'm seeing in others. And it's sometimes that's based, like he said, on ignorance. Ignorance is not a derogatory term. It's a sign that someone doesn't have proper knowledge. They're ignorant of a topic. And it's I know he meant it in a different way in this context, but it is something that fear is something that can pervade people's decisions. It can make them take different action. And again, I think we talked about it last episode on the causes of fear. We definitely have to do a whole topic, a whole episode on fear itself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think superstition and prejudice and ignorance go hand in hand, right? A lot of people are superstitious, prejudice, you know, against things that they're ignorant of, right? Because they don't understand it. They're afraid of it. You know, whether it's, you know, how to deal with COVID-19, whether it's, you know, people from different backgrounds that they've never been exposed to, either in a work or a personal, you know, setting. But, you know, it can be a huge limiting factor, you know, if it's just certain things you can't get past. And especially if it's... ignorance is the cause of it. You know, if there's no valid reason why you're feeling these things, especially, you know, in 2020, right? It's one thing where, you know, we didn't understand as much about the world worked, and, you know, there wasn't all of human information at the tip of your fingers, you know? Right. Yeah, but now, yeah, I mean, it's just something that if you're going to be, you know, superstitious or, you know, prejudiced with no basis in fact, you're going to have a hard time being successful.
Absolutely. Number 19, the wrong selection of vocation. No man can succeed in a line of endeavor which he does not like. The most essential step in the marketing of personal services is that of selecting an occupation into which you can throw yourself wholeheartedly. I heard a saying one time, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah.
And that is probably what this is referring to, that if you can do something you love day after day after day, you're going to be much more successful than slaving away in some sweatshop that you just can't stand.
Yeah, I think this one becomes really difficult to navigate if you happen to be really good at something, but you don't like it or you're not passionate about it. So that, I mean, I think that could be tricky, you know, in both of our lines of work, right? So, I mean, obviously, everything you go through to become a doctor, there's a lot of weeding out process. You know, you have to have diligence, you know, intelligence, all these things. But I know you probably have friends that went all the way through medical school and you're like, you know, I really was hoping I was going to fall in love with this, but I don't like it. And then they end up doing something, you know, which is crazy. I mean, I don't know as many doctors. I know a ton of lawyers that have done that, you know, not as much, you know, total schooling and residency and everything like that. But I mean, to go to get a 4-year degree, go to law school for 3 years, pass the bar, and then be like, I hate this work. You know, right. I mean, that's a hell of a lot of wrong, you know, it's a hell of a lot of student loans and pain to, you know, to screw up your vocation. But I definitely have seen people do it, you know, so it's
funny. I just had a flashback when you said that. I mentioned medical school. So my 4th year of medical school, you know, when you sit in this giant auditorium, the first 2 years of your life there, mm-hmm. and generally the same people sit around you all the time.
Yeah.
Well, there was this guy that sat one row directly in front of me, one row down from me, and he rarely spoke. So for like 2 years, the guy rarely said a word, right? It was really strange. He was a good student, you know, and everything. And he would go to, you know, we'd never see him at any study halls or anything. He would just show up, go to class. Every once in a while, he'd turn around and hand you something, you know. But what was funny is like, it was our fourth year. So we're like almost out the door, right? And everybody's sort of, you know, kind of on our way. We know where we're going to head. And it's right before everybody's going to get their match, you know, like they're going to match to a residency or whatever.
Yeah.
And he just like turns around out of the blue, and there's like my little cohorts of people sitting next to me. And he says, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking. I mean, this is like probably the, you know, fifth word he said. He says, I've been doing a lot of thinking. I've decided I really don't like people. It's like, oh my gosh. We all just kind of looked at him like he spoke, first off.
Yeah.
And then secondly, it was just kind of like dumbfounded that this is his realization sitting in the middle of this class that he just decided he doesn't like people. And he says, I think I'm going to change my match. I'm going into pathology.
Yeah.
So he'd rather look at a microscope than people.
Well, I was going to say, he's probably perfect for the people we need right now, just researching viruses under a microscope, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you can choose the wrong job. You can you can just, your whole, what you choose to spend your time on, generally speaking, it's better to spend time on what you love to do. Now, I've spoke with a lot of, this is a common theme in medicine. I've said this many times on our show before. There's a lot of people that come to see me, and there's common themes, things that people struggle with. One of them is definitely this one. I think this number 19, wrong selection of vocation, has to be probably in the top five, as far as I'm concerned, as far as things that can really screw people's life up. You know, I've got people that work ridiculous hours. When you talk to somebody about exercise and nutrition, and they have to be at work by 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. and they get home at 7 p.m. But they have an hour and a half drive both ends of that. You know, I mean, it just becomes, you realize, I stop myself sometimes when I talk to folks like that, and it doesn't make sense for me to start, well, you really ought to exercise 30 to 45 minutes. They just kind of look at me and roll their eyes, you know. They're like, it's because their hierarchy of needs are not being met. And I try to convince people to just look up from that. You know, look up and decide maybe you're in the wrong vocation. Maybe you could do something else. Maybe when you do get a day off, try something else, you know?
Well, I was going to say, I know a lot of my family members and friends, especially in your part of the world, that is so easy to do, because there are so many really good, I say good jobs, and you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes. And I say it's good because the pay is relatively high for the level of experience or skill or schooling you have, right? I mean, you can work your butt off and make a really good living and make a good livelihood. I mean, you know, one of my brothers is, you know, really well off, and he's been working at a refinery for 30 years. But I mean, I think the hard part about it is once you, and I think it covers it in later in the list, but you get stuck in these traps, right? So a lot of these people, if you get a job making X amount of money, it's really hard to leave with the skills you have, right? To make that lifestyle fit and pay your mortgage and everything. So you're kind of screwed, you know, unless you take time to, you know, take 6 months or a year to say, hey, I'm going to have to start putting money away. I need to go back to school. I need to, you know, change my vocation. But it's difficult to do in stream. So,
yeah, and I think this will tie into some of the coming ones, like you said. Number 20 is lack of concentration of effort. The jack of all trades, that's in quotes, seldom is good at any. Concentrate all your efforts on one definite chief aim. I want to say real quick, this is probably one that I've been guilty of in my life. I'm a person who has diverse interests, let's say. I've been an athlete. I'm a doctor. I coach. I love soccer. I race cars. I love farming and you know, running
and now podcasting.
I mean, I'm a guy that this could be my doom, you know, that lack of concentration of effort. Now, I do focus on certain areas, and I have very complicated systems of balancing my life and things like that. But there have been multiple times in my life where I felt rather burned out, probably because I just didn't focus on what I needed to focus on at one time, and I spread myself too thin. I'm sure there's a lot of military analogies for spreading your forces too thin, and you know what that can do. But this is one that really resonates with me.
Well, I was going to say, at least the good thing with you is you made a decision, you know, early in your adult life that you know, obviously you have one specialized skill, being a doctor, that is good. And so that, I think a lot of it is I think you can be a jack of all trades. You just can't be, I don't think, a jack of all trades in all of your life's endeavors. You know, you see people, right. You can't go from job to job. You can't be, you know, a jack of all trades when you have your resume out there. Like, good God, what do you do? It's like, well, I have a degree in biology, but you know, I worked in IT and I mean, it does happen, but I was going to say, there was a quote that came up when I was, researching and doing some notes on this, and it was the Bruce Lee quote talking about, I fear not the man who practiced 10,000 kicks once, I fear the man who practiced one kick 10,000 times.
Yes.
So it's like, I mean, there's slippery slopes all around that, but I think, I understand his point. But I think you can be diverse in different aspects of your life, but you do need to be, a subject matter expert is another term you'll hear. You need to be really good at something in your life. Like what you're, and it could be, what you're passionate about. It could be what you're good at. You know, like we talked about in the previous one, it kind of sucks where what you like to do is not exactly what you're good at, or vice versa, you know,
right.
Thus going back to the lawyer and doctor analogies, it's like, oh, because I'm smart enough and I can do this, I can make money and do it, but that might not be what is going to make me fulfilled. Anyway, interesting.
So back to the book, number 21. The Habit of Indiscriminate Spending. The spendthrift cannot succeed, mainly because he stands eternally in fear of poverty. Form the habit of systemic saving by putting aside a definite percentage of your income. Money in the bank gives one the very safe foundation of courage when bargaining for the sale of personal services. Without money, one must take what one is offered and be glad to get it. I think this ties into that last one on wrong vocation. If you make a good living doing something and then later decide this is really not my calling, but you spend everything you make, or in modern days you can spend more than you actually make, you end up having to use your personal services, as he says, because you have to take what you're offered.
Yeah, I was going to say that in some ways, I think this is even harder in business than in your personal, finances, I guess you might say, because I've seen it a little bit before I got in the Marine Corps when I was running a business. But, I think most of us, even if you spend a little bit too much, you're like, hey, I need to, put a little bit of money in for retirement. I need to, pay down some debt. But sometimes on the business side, I mean, you have all this money coming in, and you see it even with publicly traded companies sometimes where, COVID happens and your entire business model's out the door and like you're out of business in a month. I was like shocked and appalled at some of these like big name, stores and businesses that were filing for bankruptcy within 45 days. I'm like, you've been in business 100 years and, you don't have a month's worth of income, for your multi-billion-dollar business. But, I think it's harder in some ways, right, to, sock aside money because everybody's like, oh, we need to invest it in research and development, or we need to pay bonuses. There's never a shortage of competing priorities, in business as much or more as personal finance, I think. So,
yeah, I would agree with that from a business perspective. There's always something, and one looks at it like an investment. The reality is if you just have money sitting idle, then it's not making money sometimes.
Yeah.
And that is the tricky aspect of that.
Good times.
Number 22, lack of enthusiasm. Without enthusiasm, one cannot be convincing. Moreover, enthusiasm is contagious, and the person who has it under control is generally welcome in any group of people. That's like Rex Howes.
Oh, yeah.
See prior episode with Rex Howes, our attitude guru there. This is exactly, in my mind, who wants to work with a Debbie Downer? Who wants to, you know, who wants to work with somebody that's negative all the time?
Well, and I will tell you that both in personal and, you know, military and in business dealings, there's usually a reason why. It's not always easy to uncover, but, you know, somebody could have like personal life problems. Somebody could have an illness, especially if it's somebody that had been enthusiastic before, you know, that made you want to do business or with them or be friends with them. And then you notice like something going on. But yeah, I think for me, it seems like there, whether it's personal or professional, there's usually a root cause, especially if you already had a relationship with somebody. I'm not sure if this applies more to, hey, you know, don't get in bed or don't get in business with somebody that, you know, you don't want to spend time with, or if it's like, hey, you know, don't be leery if they're not excited about something that they're trying to get you to, you know, to do. I don't know.
Well, and I mentioned Rex again, Rex Howes, because the belief is that a person who is enthusiastic, well, of course, they're positive. Enthusiasm implies that you're looking forward to something. You're expectant of something positive. Yeah. Well, that's a mindset. That's a mindset that will create success. A pessimistic mindset, a mindset of negativity, will create something negative. If you're, you know, trying to get ahead in the world, being enthusiastic and having an open mind, open arms to the world, expecting that something good can and will happen, that is, I think that's, well, attitude's everything. You know,
yeah, you know what's crazy about that? And I'm doing this program that I'm sure we'll talk about in an episode at one point, but there's a class that we're taking in conjunction with it, and it's all about resiliency. And it's pretty cool. It's a class. It's a free class through this program, but it's a University of Pennsylvania class through their psychology department. And the professor, one of the first things that struck me, she talked about, you know, there's definitive proof now that I think it's something similar to like depression, right? She said people are born more optimistic or pessimistic. Now that's not, you know, 80% of your DNA, but she says, you know, as much as they can deduce that, about 40 to 50% of your optimism or pessimism is genetic. And there's like another mix of 40% this and 10% something else. But this, one of the huge modules in this class is how to, you know, what is optimism and how to train yourself to be more optimistic. But in terms of this, like lack of enthusiasm or optimism, I was like, wow. So you're telling me, I guess it's just like depression. I mean, you could be born, half glass, half, you know, empty kind of person. I was like, geez, you know, that's kind of an eye opener. But the fact that you can control, similar like to health, right? You know, I'm sure you talk to people, oh, doc, I was born, all these genetic problems. It's like, yeah, but that is only X percentage. You know, you can still have a huge influence through diet, exercise. So I think it's the same thing with optimism versus pessimism. I mean, you may be wired more a certain way, but that doesn't mean that you throw the baby out with the bathwater and you're like, well, I guess I just hate everybody, you know?
Yeah. Well, when it comes down to the debate of genes versus environment, I think that in many respects, environment is definitely a huge factor. Yeah. Even things that when you look at, and I'm not negating what they're teaching in that class, but what I'm saying is even things that seem like they're genetic, enthusiasm or positivity, negativity, things like that, even those things can be very subtle. They can have environmental influences, such as a mother who's under a tremendous amount of stress during a pregnancy, or the first 2 to 3 years of the child's life. The child has a mother that is distant because of environmental stressors or whatever. There's actually that actually can, just the way that they handle or interact with a child even before they can even speak can change in their view of the world. There's I won't get into it today. It's probably could do a topic on that alone, but there's a lot of evidence that our early childhood and even sort of in our genetic lineage, stressors and things that impacted our forefathers can impact our behavior, either through taught or through they believe, even potentially some hormonal and genetic factors. So yeah, I think incredible. That's kind of out in the fringes there, but maybe one of these days I'll dig that back out and we can review that together. There's a lot of research that backs that up, by the way.
Yeah, interesting.
Next one, number 23, intolerance. The person who has a closed mind on any subject seldom gets ahead. Intolerance means that one has stopped acquiring knowledge. The most damaging forms of intolerance are those connected with religious, racial, and political differences of opinion. Wow.
Yeah.
He wrote this in 1930-something, and look what's happening in our world right now.
Yeah, I think, going back to some of the other, sources of failure we talked about, that I think it was the superstition and intolerance is part. It's superstition and prejudice. I mean, they're all wrapped up in together. And I think, I've talked to a lot of my friends about this, especially with what's going on in the world. And I think sports and the military are two of the best things that really help to break down those barriers, is because, you know, a lot of times people can grow up in the same hometown, go to the same schools that their parents went to, even through college, and they're essentially in a bubble. Right. And that can be from any race or ethnicity, or, sometimes it's even regional. You talk about people from the South versus, especially people from the Northeast or California. So I think things like sports and the military, travel start to get people out of these bubbles. So honestly, I think generally people are good and have good intentions. And I think a lot of this intolerance is out of either ignorance or just, lack of exposure because of their worldview.
I have to mention my Uncle Bob. My Uncle Bob was an awesome guy. He died about 3 years ago. He was well past 85 years old. He was in great health right up until the day he died. And what was interesting about Bob is he took me under his wing whenever I was coming out of college, getting ready to go to medical school. He had been a very, very successful optometrist in the San Francisco Bay Area, had one of the biggest practices there for like 30, 40 years. Great guy. Everyone loved him, had an extended group of friends, and he was just an amazing person. One day he called me. I was probably a junior in college, and he said, Hey, Bill, I want you to come to stay with me for the summer in San Francisco. He says, you can't go to medical school growing up in South Texas, living in Waco, and never seeing the world. You need to get out, and you need to see how other people live.
Yeah.
And what was an interesting experience, and he took me out there, and it wasn't, of course, San Francisco, a very liberal town, and lots of different things going on there. And it wasn't that he was trying to shock me into, oh, look how wild it is here, or look how wild it is there. Although we went and, kind of explored the city and all the wonderful strangeness that goes on in San Francisco. But what he did is he would take me to some of the seediest, dangerous, incredible places in that town at the time. And then he would also take me and we'd go to the Orpheum Theater and we'd sit in a $300 a seat ticket and wear tuxedos. And literally we went and rented tuxedos and went to this show and watched, an amazing theater and watched this amazing show and hobnobbed and sipped, champagne with people that we didn't know because he wanted to show me. And he always would tell me, that's interesting, isn't it? And look how these people live. And it was all races, creeds, all kinds of cross dressers and all the things you can imagine that go on in San Francisco. It's just this big melting pot of America there. And what happened is he brought me there on purpose to teach me that, hey, don't have such a closed mind on everything. The people are just people. It's better to figure out how you fit in and how you can help others, and regardless of their race, their religion, their sexual orientation, or their politics. I mean, I think probably he was fairly liberal in his politics, but he would love to just openly debate things and not in a negative way that's like judgmental and things like that. He was so neutral that way, and I just hats off to him. As soon as I read this, I thought of him and what a major impact he had on me as a physician, because now, and he did that on purpose, because now he would, he, you know, if I see somebody that comes in that's got a little different background or is in a different place, or they just sort of don't fit the mold of the average South Texan or whatever, know, I just kind of like, it's okay with me. I'm not judgmental about these things. I just think it's okay. And it's okay because that's where that person is. And then, like, my uncle would tell me, you know, how can you help them?
Yeah, I mean, intolerance. Yeah, it's I think it's sad because, like I said, I'm not even say just the vast majority. I mean, I want to say, you know, 90-95% of the people, almost barring people that have criminal nature and are just in some cases unfixable, I think most people want good for other people. You know, maybe I'm naive, but like I said, I was lucky when I grew up. I was born in Georgia and lived there for a while, moved to South Texas, and then moved back to Georgia and back to South Texas. And so the cool thing about that is, you know, those were two environments where, you know, the average white kid wasn't, you know, always the majority in those areas. You know, I was right. In and around the Atlanta area and in South Texas. And so I think for me, it was good because, I mean, I was probably surrounded by more people that didn't look like me than people that did look like me for the majority of my years. And then you couple that with, you know, sports and then the military in my, you know, younger adult life. And like I said, I think your example and my example show it, you know, it's not always that, you know, you have to be born into this like perfectly accepting, you know, no sense of intolerance. It's like, hey, you know, you're exposed to things as you grow up. Hopefully your parents do it. But if not, you know, you really need to, and in our cases for parents, you know, you want to force your kids into, you know, diverse and sometimes even uncomfortable situations so that they're not seeing those things for the first time when they're adults and they have to make some kind of value judgment on it, right?
Right.
So
absolutely. Mm. Number 24, I think this one's fairly straightforward. Intemperance. The most damaging forms of intemperance are connected with eating, strong drink, and sexual activities. Overindulgence in any of these is a fatal to success. I think that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, it's self-discipline. I know for me, everybody's got something that's a vice, right?
Right.
Whether it be food, alcohol. I mean, for God's sakes, now people don't think about it like that. I mean, they're starting to now, but your phones, Netflix, you know, any of these things can be, something that's intemperate. And even if you don't think that you're falling down a pitfall, I think it's good to put healthy controls like before you have to. You know, it's like, hey, I know for me, especially with quarantine and being 100% telework, I mean, you know, I was drinking alcohol like, you know, 6 or 7 days a week for,
right.
2 months. And then, you know, and thankfully I work out a lot and I generally eat healthy. So I wasn't seeing a lot of weight gain or negative side effects. But, you know, at some point I was like, hey, I'm not going to drink during the week. You know, I'm going to at least have, you know, 4 or 5 days a week where, you know, I don't drink any alcohol, you know, just as like a self-discipline thing. So
yeah.
I think that people need to do that. You know,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Number 25, inability to cooperate with others. More people lose their positions and their big opportunities in life because of this fault than for any other reasons combined. It is a fault which no well-informed businessman or leader will tolerate. I mean, I think this is huge because there's a lot of folks that just can't be on a team. They just either they must have their own way, or they just can't tolerate other people's opinions. And a person who can't cooperate with others can't build a team. And teams get way more done than an individual person.
Yeah, I think I've had different bosses, and my dad maybe even said it like this: like, nobody wants to work with or for an asshole. you know, I mean, it's just like, I almost want to leave it at that. And my only other thoughts on it are, the people who think that they can, you know, throw their weight around or intimidate people, you're only going to go so far with that. You know, people, as soon as you walk out of the room, they're going to make fun of you or they're going to do the bare minimum. So it never pays to be an a-hole, you know, whether it's the military or in any line of work or so, yeah, don't be an a-hole.
Yep. And if you are dealing with an a-hole, check out episode, what was it, number 2 or 3
of our series?
That was one of our early, stoic introductory topics.
Yeah, fun venting.
Yes. Number 26, possession of power that was not acquired through self-effort. And this implies maybe sons or daughters of wealthy men and others who inherit money which they did not earn. Power in the hands of one who did not acquire it gradually is often fatal to success. Quick riches are more dangerous than poverty. What do you think of that?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at historical examples, I mean, even the richest people that ever lived in our country, you know, the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and, you know, the Carnegies, their heirs never, you know, came close to expanding, you know, their empires or influence like they're, you know, the matriarchs or the patriarchs. They it just almost never happens. And so I think looking at history and, you know, I know Warren Buffett and some other, you know, current magnates of, you know, wealth and industry have said that they're going to leave their money to charity, you know, largely. I mean, they're going to leave some money to their family, but I mean, it poisons the well, honestly. I mean, if you know when you turn 18, you're going to get like $1 billion, you know, what incentive is that going to give you to build up your own self, you know?
Yeah, I think the effort, the crucible that people go through when they're trying to acquire wealth or get ahead in the world, the experiences that they have are what shape them and help them make the decisions that they make. And I think when someone has everything handed to them, though I don't really, I mean, it's nice to have that to begin with, you know, that sort of advantage doesn't mean someone that's inherits things couldn't be very successful, but it definitely can affect someone's ability because they don't really have that true crucible experience. So, yeah definitely.
Yeah, I was going to say that, I mean, you know, like the point you were making, there are a lot of people that can do well enough, right? They've been given they've inherited or, you know, they have somebody that works in a company and hires them in at a very prestigious position that other people would have to work for. I mean, you can get and keep a modicum of success like that, even, you know, be very successful. But if you look at the most successful people, you know, in your current sphere of influence or, you know, especially in history, almost none of them were handed things. I mean, you look at, you know, Jeff Bezos, you know, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, all these people, you know, even a lot of some of the best doctors, surgeons, and researchers, you know, came from, you know, humble beginnings. And a lot of that, like you said, that crucible coming up made them that much better, that much different. You know, people that are given stuff, yeah, they might, you know, have a nice house and send their kids to prep school, but they're not going to be people that others write books about, you know, right. or even people in their, you know, personal lives look up to, because it's like, oh yeah, so-and-so's dad did this or they got hired for that. So there's always going to be that, I think, asterisk. You know, actually, we talked to Chris Long about it. I mean, his dad was a Hall of Fame, legendary, you know, player at you know, pretty much the same position. And so he's like, you know, I knew I was never going to be my dad. And so he actually worked that much harder because he wanted to get things on his own, you know, not just saying, oh, well, you're Howie Long's kid, so of course you're going to make the team. So, you know, he had an interesting right. perspective on that from a different, you know, sports aspect. So,
yeah, for sure. Nearing the end here, number 27. Intentional dishonesty. There is no substitute for honesty. One may be temporarily dishonest by forces of circumstances over which one has no control without permanent damage, but there is no hope for the person who is dishonest by choice. Sooner or later, his deeds will catch up with him, and he will pay by loss of reputation and perhaps even loss of liberty. This one kind of reminds me of one of the earlier causes of failure, and that we had kind of made the comment, you'd made the comment that people are inherently positive and, you know, they tend to want to do good for other people. Mm-hmm. I think when a person is dishonest or criminal in their attempts to get ahead in the world, I think what's happening is you're just sort of running countercurrent to the, you know, karma of the world. And I think when people are dishonest, there's a certain negative energy that they are, you know, dragging with them, and ultimately it drags them down. And I think goodness generally catches up with everyone.
Yeah, I'll say that I probably learned this this lesson most forcefully, I'll say, in the military, because early on, you know, in officer candidate school, one of the first things, I mean, you could fail tests, you could fail physical events and, you know, fall out of runs and hikes. But if you ever did anything that even smelled like dishonesty, integrity, unethical in nature, I mean, you were gone. And it was like, even things that, now granted, that's like the beginning of entry level training. So they're like, hey, if you're going to do this here where you're under a microscope, what are you going to do when you're like in charge of 50 people out on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan? You know, right. I mean, you know, what if you, you know, kill a POW? You know, are you going to be the one to cover it up? I mean, there's a huge slippery slope there. But I mean, yeah, I remember examples where we were supposed to separate all of our, you know, civilian clothes, attire, you know, any medications that we brought that were over the counter or anything. It was supposed to be in our personal luggage, zipped away. And if you kept anything that they found, I mean, you were gone. I mean, I think in some cases people forgot and didn't claim it during the amnesty period. And people, you know, got caught with a bottle of Tylenol and were kicked out of officer candidate school. Wow. And yeah, I mean, so, but I mean, when that happens one time, everybody's like, oh shit. Right. You know, they're not playing around. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of any business and, you know, especially in certain lines of work, I mean, you just cannot, tolerate dishonesty. And if you do it yourself, you know, you might get by once or twice or, you know, cheat the system, but it's going to catch up with you. And it's definitely not a long-term successful plan. So
number 28, egotism and vanity. These qualities serve as red lights, which warn others to keep away. They are fatal to success. Yeah. This one is actually fairly deep. I think could go in many different directions, but the way he worded this, they are red lights, which warn others to keep away.
Yeah, I think it's you know, counterintuitive in some I would say compared to some I guess models of success, because you know, some things would say, hey, you have to be a little bit egotistical, you have to, because I think sometimes when I've read you know, improvement books or heard people talk, I mean, it borderlines to, you know, vanity, like the confidence to the point where, hey, you know, everybody, you have to be so confident that nobody sees any cracks in your armor. And if you are trying to be that perfect, if you're trying to be that, you know, kind of guy or girl, you know, you're gonna build up a overly inflated ego that people are going to see through, and it's going to rear its ugly head. So I think, you know, I always err on the side of humility and being self-aware.
Yeah. The other thing about vanity, think about pro sports or athletes. You know, you ever seen, like, everybody loves to see the guy that's like cocky, you know, he's like showboating and putting on a big show before the big fight. And there's always somebody out there. I mean, I know I'm one that just, I'd like to see a more humble fighter, one that just kind of goes in and does their job, you know, but everyone sort of roots against that guy that's the showboater. And I think the one that doesn't want to shake hands. Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of like that. It's a general red light that nobody wants to see in others, that look at my ego, look how big I am, look how, you know, how sharp I am, and nobody can touch me. And that self, that vanity and ego, that's a turnoff for people. I mean, he phrased it in this as a red light, which others, you know, warns others to keep away. But he listed this as very serious language. They are fatal to success. I think that's true. People with very strong egos have trouble working with others, because by definition, the ego needs to be fed. It's not interested in doing for others. It's doing for itself, for its own benefit. Same thing with vanity. If one is so vain that everyone, look at me, look at how awesome I am, that's a turnoff, and it's not conducive to, you know, a team. It's not conducive to success. And I think that's, again, multiple of these, I've looked at them and said we could do an entire episode on that, because I sense several rabbit holes I could run down with that. But we're near the end here. Let's go on to number 29.
Yep.
Guessing instead of thinking. Most people are too indifferent or lazy to acquire the facts with which they think accurately. They prefer to act on opinions created by guesswork or snap judgment. Let me think of that.
Yeah, I've had some really good analytical bosses that drove me crazy, but I will tell you that they taught me to really be able to avoid this, because, you know, I mentioned earlier making data-driven decisions. You know, a lot of times I'm really intuitive, usually in a good way, but I know when I was younger, a little more immature, even when I was an adult, I would tend to say, hey, you know, let's go down this path, which is good to be decisive. But I think having other bosses or leaders say, well, you know, have you looked at the different, you know, courses of action? Have you considered all sides? And I think that, you know, once you're, you know, I said, making logical decisions, and you get better at training yourself to be a logical decision maker, you can really avoid, you know, this pitfall altogether.
Yeah. And one thing he didn't mention, but I think gets lumped in here, is emotional decision making. And I guess that falls under maybe snap judgments, things like that.
Yeah.
But especially if it's based on just a raw emotion. I mean, emotion is a big part of decision making and should be respected. If there's a strong emotion associated with something, there's usually a reason at some subconscious level. But at the same time, a snap judgment, there's a whole science to decision making, and as you well know. And I think when people don't take enough time to make good decisions, they're just sort of like a mouse bouncing off of walls and stuff. You know, they're not thinking through what they're doing. They're just in the maze and reacting to the world instead of trying to predict and take best next action steps.
Yeah. And sometimes I think it's lazy, honestly. I mean, if you're working with somebody or for somebody that's doing this too often, like if they're not even willing to look at the data or be logical about it when it's available, sometimes, honestly, it's just being lazy. You know, do your homework and you can avoid a lot of bad judgments, honestly.
So we've gotten all the way down to the last one on the list, number 30 of the causes of failure, lack of capital. This is a common cause of failure among those who start a business for the first time without sufficient reserve of capital to absorb the shock of their mistakes and to carry them over until they have established a reputation. So I thought that, you know, of course, there's a lot of business and a lot of, you know, how to be successful in business. Of course, a lot of these are successful in life too. But I, you know, that's true. I can see there's times in my business career I've done nothing but run my own business most of my life, and there's times when I wish I had more capital and I could have done. I felt like I could have done more things if I was better capitalized in some situations.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting that this is the very last one on the list. But if we're taking a business mindset, I mean. You know, the plan for how you get this and how you keep and maintain and grow it is a huge part of being successful, you know, in business. I know I work for a large privately held company, and one of the big questions was always, you know, when are we going to go public? And some people were excited about it because obviously if you'd been with the company for a while, you were going to maybe get stock options or other, you know, sweet incentives. But it was a family owned company. They've been around for a long time. They said, hey, it came down to capital, you know, even for like a international multi-billion-dollar privately held company. They said, hey, if we get to a point where we can't be competitive with our competitors because of a lack of capital, that's really the only reason, you know, a company like ours needs to go public, you know? So that's another, you know, it's like, you don't do it for the wrong reasons. It's like, if you, you know, have a lot of money in reserve, but you're investing in the future and you're, you know, you're competitive, but you know, sometimes in certain industries, I mean, you have to have that influx of capital to, you know, compete with marketing, compete with growth, things like that. But, you know, it's definitely something that is a huge part of business. I mean, there's whole separate businesses and, you know, entities that are obviously involved with just providing the capital. I mean, you know, the banking system and, you know, multiple other types of lenders. I mean, they exist to do that because there is a need. So it's interesting, though. This list, I think, was very all-encompassing, and like you said, each one of them could, or maybe not every one, but you know, quite a few of them could be its own topic. So it's kind of interesting that it ended with kind of a hard business bullet, I guess.
Well, there is one final thing. It's not really a cause of failure, but he listed as number 31. So I want to review this or read it, and I want, you know, and I think it's really a challenge, is what I read it as. Let's see what you think. Number 31. Under this, name any particular cause of failure from which you have suffered that has not been included in the foregoing list. In these 30 major causes of failure is found a description of the tragedy of life, which obtains for practically every person who tries and fails. It will be helpful if you can induce someone who knows you well to go over this list with you and help you analyze you by the 30 causes of failure. It may be beneficial if you try this alone. Most people cannot see themselves as others see them. You may be one who cannot. So kind of a parting shot from the 1930s to say, hey, look, these are all the 30 ways, and number 31 can be any other way I couldn't think of that you can screw your life up or cause failure.
Well, the funny thing is, it's like even though it's baked into some of those other ones, that's essentially a shot almost at your personal self-awareness, right? I mean, saying, sure. Hey, you know, I mean, it's kind of saying, hey, it's hard to trust yourself to give an honest assessment of the things that you're most likely to fail at.
Yes.
And so I think that that's, there's a lot of wisdom. And it's amazing that some of these things, I mean, we talk about Stoic philosophy, obviously written thousands of years ago, but, you know, this, I mean, is very timely and, you know, written almost 100 years ago now. So, I mean, there's so many things that we can learn really from human nature. I mean, for me, I think that people get fascinated with technology and all these things that are coming in the future and virtual, but I think you can never know too much about human nature and yourself because, I mean, we're kind of in a people business, you know, regardless of if you're talking about being a dad or, you know, running a business or, you know, running yourself. I mean, you can get virtual. We can get even integrated with machines. But until we're ceasing to exist, I mean, you know, human nature is going to be the biggest study that I know I'm going to, you know, endeavor to learn about. So,
absolutely. Well, Chris, it's been another great episode, and I would like to go ahead and remind our listeners about the tribe that we have on the Future Focus Health Network that's dedicated for the WFO Life podcast. I think that others might have some interesting insights on these last two episodes and how maybe they've seen this impact their lives. So I invite everyone to check out that forum so that we can communicate with you and love to carry on this conversation with others in our group. And I know that group is really growing and there's some interesting and really talented people that kind of read and follow along in there. So I guess that's all I got tonight, Chris. You got anything else before we close out?
No, I think I'm going to try to, you know, stir the pot a little bit in the WFO Live podcast tribe just to try to, you know, spur people along into discussion on this because I'm interested to hear what they have to say.
Absolutely. All right, man. Have a great night.
Yeah, you too. Out.